morning. I'm reconvening hearings. This hearing stream is to hear the zoning issues surrounding the ski area subzones. Panel for this hearing stream I have on my left, Commissioner Hill, who is a planner from Auckland, and on my right, Commissioner Scott, the carried on the board council. Sorry, Commissioner Stephen. One of the names is Scott, but Stephen. Ms. Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the panel. I have filed some written legal submissions on Thursday last week. I understand there's a copy in front of you. Other information in front of you is a copy of the council's evidence and also the highlight summary for each of the council's witnesses. Turning first to my written legal submission. So we have moved on from the hearing on the text of stage one of the proposed district plan and are now moving into the hearings on submissions on planning map annotations such as land stack lines and zone boundaries. This hearing is the first of these and relates to the extension of notified ski area subzones. In terms of the rezoning submissions that make up the scope of this hearing, submissions...
Could I just interrupt for a second? Can you sort out what that noise is?
The rezoning submission that are being considered in this hearing relates to extensions of serious subzones either located near or adjacent to the notified serious subzones at Coronet Peak, the Remarkable, Cadrona and Preble Cone. These opening submissions address our first a strategic overview of the serious subzone, which I'm going to refer to as subzone as I can see. The application of the landscape policy framework to the subzone. There we go. Definitions are relevant to ski area activities, earthworks in the subzone, council's reliance on its right of reply position, the relevance of case law on the existing environment and permitted baselines to plan reviews, some specific issues relating to individual subzones, and then the evidence to be called in support of the council's position. I refer to and adopt the opening legal submission presented at the strategic directions hearing in terms of council's functions and statutory obligations and relevant legal considerations. In paragraphs 1.5 and 1.6, I refer to the King Salmon case, which sets out the principle that there is a presumption that where higher order planning documents are established, they can be assumed to be in accordance with part two. At paragraph 1.6, I refer to the relevance of this principle in the context of this hearing. The relevant higher order regional planning document, in this case is the Otago Regional Policy Statement. It is currently under review. In any event, it must be given effect to and the relevant objectives are identified in this bad strategic evidence. None of these are directives in the King Salmon sense in the context of the issues at hand. The proposed regional policy statement remains under appeal and therefore is not an established higher order planning document. In the case of the proposed RPS, this distinguishes the current situation from the King Salmon principle. The New Zealand
coastal policy statement is irrelevant to the district, and now the national policy is of little relevance to this hearing.
Isn't the important issue when you're dealing with zoning such as this that the agendas and policies that are contained within the plan itself are the starting point? And if they satisfy all the issues in a King's Salmon sense, it may not be necessary to go to Part 3.
That is the case where the objectives are established. Where there is dispute as to what those objectives should say, then the King's Salmon principle is not as strong as what you suggested. In the case of a plan change, or even a partial review, where relevant objectives are not being changed, then yes, that is the case.
So where does that leave us if reference to Part 2 leads us to a different conclusion to what a different hearing panel may have come to in dealing with the text, the objectives and policies?
Is your question whether there may be a difference in opinion between different constituents?
Well, I'm just thinking largely that the argument about, I mean, clearly talking about outstanding natural landscapes in this issue and in this set of hearings, Screen 1 panel has come to a series of conclusions on defence and policies that apply in outstanding natural landscapes. And the rural spring panel has come to conclusions as to bits and policies and assessment criteria that apply in the rural zone. Now those are all put effectively under challenge because they all, A, only we know what they say, B, they're all liable to be appealed, potentially. Does that mean that submitters can reference Part 2 rather than any objectives and policies framework that may have even been put to us?
Yes, so the Council submission Part 2 is relevant in this instance and in the example that you've just described. It does confront an issue in that the Council, and I will return to this, is relying on its recommended position that it has put to earlier panels and hearings. Some of the submitters are relying on their position that they have taken to earlier hearings and panels.
Jim, can I ask a question to say along those same lines? I mean, in your 1.6, you talk about the proposed RPS and in relation to landscape and there are a number of appeals. So then, presumably, the operative regional policy statement is a document that's clearly operative, and so greater weight must be given to that. Is that what your submission is? What you've said here seems to almost say, you won't propose, and because it's appeal, it's not a higher order, but then don't say anything about the operative, because they're a bit different.
Yes, sorry, so the operative RPS must be given effect to, so in terms of weight, it's actually a different statutory text
exactly
for that document. The submission is that there are actually no directive policies in the operative regional policy statement that are of any relevance, and therefore essentially kick in the King Salmon principle. It's not particularly guiding on what
right
the Council should do in its district plan.
And in terms of saying that, are you saying that the plan already gives effect to it? I suppose it's an extension to the question of the objectives and policies in the proposed plan, whatever the outcome is it your submission that they, in terms of the Council's position anyway, give effect to the operative?
In this hearing, yes.
Yes.
And that is a matter that's been addressed through various hearings.
Thank you.
Turning to a strategic overview of the subzones, The subzone is a planning mechanism that provides for a subzone located within the primary rural zone. The notified extent of the subzone boundaries in the proposed district plan have been rolled over from the operative district plan, both unchanged and unchallenged in their location. The subzone provides an alternative regulatory framework to enable ski area activities to occur in defined locations, as well as some limited activities via a consenting approach that balances the economic benefits of this tourism offering to the district with environmental considerations. At a strategic level, the purpose of the subzone is to enable continued development of skiing and activities ancillary to skiing within its boundaries, recognising the importance of these activities to the economy of the district. The scope of the subzone's purpose was recommended to be broadened through the rural hearing to recognise the subzone as providing year-round destinations for ski area, tourism and recreational activities. This broadening was recommended in isolation from considering the effects of expanding the geographic extent of the subzone, which is now the question for this hearing. The purpose of the expansion of what the subzone enables was to effectively recognise that current operations occurring within some of the existing subzones have already expanded into all-season commercial recreation facilities offering activities outside of winter. Importantly, provisions seek to consolidate ski area activities within the subzone. So in short, expanding the notified extent of the subzone boundary is a different concept to expanding the broader purpose of the notified subzone, subzone located in alpine environments. The matters of national importance set out in Section 6 of the RNA represent values that must be recognised and provided for when considering appropriate locations or zones. One method for representing these Section 6 values are outstanding natural landscape overlays on the planning map. It is therefore of direct relevance that, apart from a part of the rezoning requested by NZSki on the lower slopes of the Remarkables, all of the requested subzones are located entirely within various ONLs, and you'll hear evidence from Dr. Reid on the effects of extending the subzones over these landscapes. The planning evidence for the various submitters has been provided by three different witnesses, and three bespoke planning frameworks have been proposed to attempt to address the concerns raised in Council's evidence in chief. This in itself demonstrates that the subzone is not designed for the areas of land being pursued by submitters. A common theme is the refined relief seeking bespoke corridors or further subzones or overlays within what is already a subzone in order to allow a passenger lift system or a gondola. Ultimately, these submitters are now using one subzone rule, which is the controlled activity rule for passenger lift systems, and hanging that rule off the subzone effectives and policies in order to justify what is submitted to essentially be one bespoke rule within the rural zone. The core activities permitted under the existing subzones are excluded from the bespoke provisions, further demonstrating the complexity of the planning framework being pursued. Paragraph 2.7, I set out the Council's position on the various rezonings. The two rezonings at Coronet Peak are opposed by the Council. NZSki has advised through its evidence that it accepts the Commissioner's findings in respect of the rezoning for Coronet Peak based upon the Council's evidence. At the Remarkables, through its rebuttal planning evidence, one rezoning request known as Area 1 is recommended to be accepted, although with the qualifier that the submitter's proposed no-build area remains zoned rural. In preparing for the hearing, however, it has come to the Council's attention that NZSki has based their submission on GIS boundaries rather than the planning map boundaries. The GIS boundary of the district is incorrect in that it includes a sliver of land within the central Otago district. And as a result, that component of the Area 1 rezoning submission that Ms Banks recommends be accepted is in fact located within the neighbouring district and is therefore not within the jurisdiction of the Council nor this hearing.
Just on that point, can someone at some stage draw on a topo over underlay where the boundaries lie, because if that is correct and the ski area subzone boundary is in the right place from our look at it on the site, the district boundary is actually about a metre or 2 metres above the toe of the slope that leads up to the top of the ridge line. Is that your understanding of where the council boundary is?
I haven't visited the site
there. No, I haven't until Tuesday either.
Yes, so Miss Banks may be able to assist in that respect. She has attached some maps to her evidence summary.
I've always presumed that the ridge line was the boundary, but it appears that it's, if that is correct, it's actually a long way below the ridge line.
Yes. So, ensuring that that matter of detail is sorted and that everyone's absolutely clear on where the boundary is. Council's position is that it did accept that extension as far as it goes to the boundary. That was before it was identified that there was an issue with the NZSK using the GIS boundary. I will ask Ms. Banks if she can't already answer that question to go away and have a look at that boundary.
Well, I would quite like us to be provided with a map showing us where it is. I've looked on the GIS system and you can put a topo map and then pull up the zoning. But it's unclear where the contour lines, just because of the laying system, it's hard to work out where the contour lines are.
We can do that. And so in terms of the no-build area within Area 1, at the Remarkables, which Mr. Skelton for NZSK had recognised as too vulnerable to landscape degradation for a subzone zoning in any event, so that area is opposed by the council, and my understanding is that is the remaining area that is in, within the Queenstown district that sought to be rezoned.
Yes, well that's where we'll also need to see that on the plan, because if the district boundary is at the toe of that slope, then some of that area is actually within Central Otago district as well. Of course, the boundary doesn't go like that, it goes like that.
So that
needs to be clarified.
Yes, and in any event, it's the council's position that no-build area should remain as rural. In terms of the remaining rezonings, the other NZSK requests also located at the Remarkables is opposed, as are the four rezonings at Cadrona. And my apologies, I haven't referenced there the rezonings at Triple Cone as well. In addition to two rezonings at Coroner Peak, no evidence has been filed in support of Cadrona's or Anderson Branch Creek submissions located at Cadrona. Now, this means for these four sites, the council's expert evidence is not disputed and the panel's recommendation should be to reject the respective submission. Turning to Section 3 in the application of the Landscape Policy Framework to the subzones, Mr. Ferguson for Soho and Triple Cone has asserted in his evidence that the council's position on the application of the landscape categories to the subzones is unclear. This has been addressed in Ms. Banks' strategic evidence and rebuttal evidence, but to assist the panel, an explanation of how this framework applies specifically to the subzones is provided in the following paragraph. Our council's references are the council's right to reply decision.
I have a problem, two problems with Ms. Banks' evidence on that. Firstly, it was not evidence that was provided to the hearing panels in streams 1 or 2. It's a completely different interpretation. Second problem I have is that it actually ignores policy 6.3.8.3. as notified, which explicitly states that the ski area subzone is excluded from the outstanding natural interest.
Yes, sir, I think Ms. Banks in her rebuttal evidence has recognised that she didn't address that specific policy and has expanded on it, as to my submission, as we've already read. In terms of Mr. Barr's evidence in hearing during 2, I'll have to go back and look at the evidence of his in the bank and compare that.
So I have to say this bank's interpretation is null. It's probably the best way that I can put it.
Okay. I take that on board and I will speak with Ms. Banks during the adjournment about that interpretation.
Yeah.
So in paragraph 3.2, chapter 6 of the proposed plan creates three classifications for the district's landscapes: outstanding natural features, outstanding natural landscapes, and rural landscapes. Chapter 6 also contains some objectives and policies addressing the subzones, as discussed in the plan strategic evidence. The landscape assessment matters for ONS and ONL are located in rule 21.7.1. Ms. Banks' strategic evidence did not discuss the detail of policy 6.3.7.3. This policy sets the framework for enabling activities within identified subzones and is a basis for buildings and ski infrastructure in the subzone to be controlled and for corresponding implementation methods 6.4.1.3a. Mr. Ferguson has noted that policy 6.3.7.3 was recommended to be retained by the reporting officer in hearing stream 1b. Mr. Ferguson also noted his view that this position could not be easily reconciled with the changes proposed to the implementation method. The implementation method sets out, or section 6.4.1 sets out how the landscape provisions apply. Implementation method 6.4.1.3 provides a limited exemption from rule 21.7.1. Under rule 6.4.1.3a, the landscape assessment matters do not apply to ski area activities within the subzone. In her rebuttal evidence, Ms. Banks explains in detail why she considers Mr. Ferguson's view on policy 6.3.7.3 and implementation method to be incorrect. She notes that the landscape categories continue to apply to ski area subzone geographic areas as they are located within the rural zone and trigger the application of the landscape assessment matters to non-ski area activities within the subzone. The landscape classifications define matters identified within section 6 and 7 of the RMA and specifically identified for management within the rural zone. These classifications have been purposefully identified irrespective of the subzone, which is an overlay over the rural zone's land. Ms. Banks has stated that it was not the Council's intention that non-ski area activities located within the subzone should have the same benefit of exemption from landscape assessment matters, since landscape effects are relevant and are an important consideration for other activities seeking to locate within the subzone. It is also relevant that any ski area activities outside the subzone is not captured by the exemption Rule 6.4.1.3, and so the landscape assessment matters would apply. For ski area activities within the subzone that require consent on a controlled or restricted discretionary basis, the landscape objectives and policies of Chapter 6 can be considered in implementing the matters of control or discretion, although the scope of the application of the Chapter 6 objectives and policies is limited by the breadth of the relevant matter of control or discretion. Otherwise, Council's rebuttal evidence has addressed submitted evidence where incorrect statements have been made about how they understood the landscape categories and assessment matters applied to the subzones and ski area activities.
I also note that, as you referred to it, policy 637.3 had no submissions on it.
So I recall that it did, because they were addressing Mr. Barr's section 42A, but the policy didn't appear to get any attention at the hearing. I will check that and confirm that with you, but that is my recollection.
I've read Mr. Robinson's report that he drafted on Chapter 6 the other day and identified that he was very thorough. As you can imagine.
I'm not doubting that.
And he said in the report there were those submissions on the site, and there can't have been, people may have referred to them in the evidence, but there were no actual submissions lodged on that submission.
Okay, I will check that. I'm not doubting Mr. Robinson's work at all. That was my resolution, but it was some time ago, and I will just check that.
Yes.
Thank you for that. In terms of the related definition, feed area activities, Mr. Barr recommended amending the definition in the rural hearing. The recommended definition specifically includes passenger lift systems, which I return to, avalanche safety, feed patrol, formation of snow trails and terrain, and installation and operation of snowmaking infrastructure. Ms. Bass has noted that a possible interpretation of this definition is that avalanche control, speed patrol and formation of snow trails and terrain are non-compliant outside of the subzone, and that this interpretation was not intended. She therefore recommends a minor clarification to Rule 21.4.19 to clarify that avalanche control, speed patrol and formation of snow trails and terrain outside of the subzone are permitted activities. Ultimately, the parties are agreed on this point, but there appears to be a residual area of disagreement in terms of the best way to represent the planning framework.
Do you want to discuss that now, or should they wait?
We can discuss it when you would like to. I'm in your hands.
Well, it seemed to me that the issue arises when someone uses a lift to get to the top of the ski field, that's considered commercial recreation, as opposed to when they walk up, where it's obviously not commercial recreation because they haven't paid anything. Has this council given any thought to whether that distinction is relevant, or is the commercial recreation, the use of the lifts in the scheme that you do for snowboarding subsequently, just recreation? Because you don't pay to use a ski field except to use the lifts.
Yes, and if you are riding on the lift, and yes, you don't always need a pass to go skiing.
Mm.
I believe that Ms. Banks has taken this into account in her evidence that this should be a permitted activity. I'll turn to Ms. Banks to clarify that. I'm not certainly
yes.
sure.
Okay.
The council's position is that a consent isn't required for those specific activities.
I understand that, and I think everyone is in agreement on
yes.
that. I'm just trying to think of a way that we can make it clear that we're not intending to capture people just because they happen to go off piste. That's considered, and that they have a ski pass attached to them, that's commercial recreation and they need a consent.
Mm.
That seems to me stupid.
Yes, and I believe it's the best way of setting that in the planning framework.
Mm.
And there's two different solutions have been put forward. In terms of passenger lift systems, in the rural hearing, Mr. Barr recommended a new definition in response to the submission of Mount Cadrona. Within the ski area activities definition, a passenger lift system replaces chair lifts, T-bars and rope tows to facilitate commercial recreational activities. The recommended passenger lift system definition specifically excludes base and terminal buildings of the mechanical system used to convey or transport passengers within or to a subzone, including chairlifts, gondolas, T-bars and rope tows. Mr. Barr's rural writer reply acknowledged that the recommended definition includes structures to enable the embarking and disembarking of passengers, but Mr. Barr recommended excluding base buildings due to the wide range of activities they could enable. The council's position remains that base buildings and terminal buildings should be excluded from the definition of passenger lift system.
any inclusion could only occur if the relevant rules and matters of discretion were expanded in scope and redrafted to cover the wider range of effects that could occur through these activities. In any event, the default status for buildings in the rural zone, which is discretionary, is submitted to be appropriate to manage the range of scales of such buildings in consideration of alternative locations and consequential effects such as landscape, servicing and traffic. Ms. Banks has recommended some minor changes to clarify the rules that relate to ski area activities and more specifically to a passenger lift system. Although a passenger lift system falls within the definition of ski area activities, there are specific controlled or restricted discretionary rules for some types within Table 7, including passenger lift systems. Ms. Banks explained that the intention behind the new definition of passenger lift system was to accommodate a gondola as a controlled activity under Table 7. She has suggested that this be resolved by a minor clarification to amend Rule 21.4.18 to add a qualifier that ski area activities are permitted in the subzone unless otherwise identified.
I spotted that problem too, and I wondered also whether, in fact, passenger lift systems need to be within the definition of ski area activity anyway. They are defined, they're specifically provided for within ski area subzones, they're controlled activities. Outside the recommendation was they be restricted discretion. I can't. The other thing that occurs to me is the only example of the gondola in the district is not, has no relationship to a ski area activity. But it is still a gondola and it still has exactly the same effects as the council is trying to control through these provisions. Is it sort of being too deeply involved in the ski area activities and actually not looked at what the activity itself is that we're dealing with?
So this specific definition has come about through a submission on the subzones, hence why it's been linked in with this specific topic in hearing. One thing that would have to be taken into account is if that approach was followed, the objectives and policies would have to be carefully looked at to ensure that they aligned with that subsequent specific rule. As drafted, the ski area activities include the likes of the gondola and therefore the terminology and objectives and policies are specific to ski area activities and doesn't go further in terms of, objectives and policies don't refer to a gondola at all.
I suspect that the submissions of Queenstown Park Limited do seek to broaden them somewhat, given that the relationship of that proposed gondola in this ski area subzone is rather tenuous. It does go to it, but the vast bulk of it has anything to do with the ski area activity.
Yeah, so that submission is there, and I understand the one you're talking about is allocated to the Queenstown hearing, because it relates quite or it's directly related to some other relief of Queenstown Park. So the matter of scope may be there, my submission there is that if that alternative was to be looked at, the council would need to very carefully consider any changes to the rules, that similar changes were reflected in the objectives and policies to ensure they stay together in the comprehensive framework.
It might be helpful if the council did that work and commented on it in the reply. Because it is clearly one of the options, and under Section 32 we do need to consider options of implementing these provisions. And I like the simpler
I would agree. One other point to add is that the council has changed the activity status for passenger lift its recommendations on the activity status for passenger lift systems outside the subzone to restricted discretionary.
Yes, that was in Mr. Barr's reply on the rural chapter anyway.
Yes,
it's just a rather unusual drafting mechanism, but that including it within a standard, but apart from that, that was the recommendation, yes.
Yes, it was, and that has been recognised in the legal submissions for Soho and Triple Cone and the supplementary evidence that's come in from Mr. Ferguson on Friday as an alternative to their the position put forward in evidence that has been recognised as partway there in terms of satisfying those submitted. I appreciate it's not the full way there, and they have some other concerns as to Rodine that will be addressed through the course of this hearing.
Yes, but my point is more fundamental, is that conflict between the ski area activities being permitted within the subzone and passenger lift systems, which are part of the definition of ski area activities, being controlled in the ski area subzone. That's where the definition issue is problematic. And it also then, if it was removed from the definition, it also obviates that problem that ski area activities outside the subzone might have a different activity classification than the passenger lift systems. They are two different activities.
Thank you, Ms. Baxter. Listen in the back of the room and we'll be listening intensely, I'm sure. So moving on to earthworks in the subzone. So under the operative district plan in chapter 22, subzones are completely exempt from the provisions of chapter 22, being earthworks. The exemption applies to the entire subzone and is not limited to particular activities within that geographic area. Of course, when this earthworks exemption in the operative plan went through the Schedule 1 process, it was in the context of the subzone boundaries as included in the operative district plan. Any exceptions to the subzone were not under contemplation. Council has resolved to review the operative district plan earthworks chapter through stage 2 of its review. It is unknown at this point in time whether the substantive content of the chapter will be revised as it applies to the subzone notified and all of the areas sought to be extended and supported through council recommendations, or whether an equivalent rule to the operative plan's exemption will be proposed, as that is ultimately a decision for council and will need to be made under relevant statutory tests, including the Section 32 evaluation. Ms. Banks' approach has been that it is reasonable to assume that the exemption may be carried over into the notified subzones as these align with the operative subzone boundaries, but not necessarily for any extensions to the boundaries of the notified subzones into new locations without carefully assessing the likely effects and appropriateness of doing so. Ms. Banks considers that it would be inappropriate for a blanket exemption from earthworks controls to apply to any extensions to the subzone, and if any rezoning to the subzone are accepted, the effects of earthworks above a certain threshold should be considered by a consent process. It is submitted that Ms. Banks' approach to earthworks in the subzone is a fair and logical response, given it is not possible to be entirely certain at this stage about the earthworks framework that will ultimately apply to the subzones, and the lack of any information assessing the effects of uncontrolled earthworks in these areas. In this respect, I refer to Mr. Dent's evidence, which suggests that earthworks should be a restricted discretionary activity within his proposed area subzone B at the Remarkable. Should any rezoning be recommended by the panel, the council opposes duplicating earthworks provisions in the rural zone or in any other zone, and any standards should be located within the earthworks chapter, which has been notified in a later stage of the review. Dr. Reid's evidence for the council is that of the possible effects of activities within the extended subzone, earthworks have the potential for significant adverse effects on landscape character, and would diminish existing qualities of naturalness. Turning to section 6, so council has relied on its recommended right of reply position through preparing its evidence for this hearing and to make recommendations as to what is the most appropriate zone for the areas under consideration. In his evidence for NZC, Mr. Dent comments on this, stating he has received legal advice that the council's right to reply are not binding, and he considers the most appropriate assessment is one that addresses the notified position. Mr. Dent is correct in that the council's reply recommendations are not binding. However, they represent council's current position, and it is both logical, efficient, and the best approach for council's experts to refer to and rely on council's most up-to-date position. The council's position takes into account the evidence that has been filed by both the council and submitted during hearing streams 1 through to 10. This is easily demonstrated by the fact that the notified provisions do not support the council's position, nor Mr. Dent's client's position, and therefore the approach suggested by Mr. Dent would not allow a true and transparent comparison of whether the provisions that are actually being recommended and are supported by the evidence before the panel would be most appropriate. Further, if the rezoning submissions were heard at the same time as submissions on the text, which was the case in the Christchurch plan review, the council would have logically and appropriately considered its recommended provisions when considering what zone is the most appropriate for a certain area of land. This approach has been taken by both the Auckland Council and Christchurch City Council plan reviews. And I note here Mr. Dent has taken his recommended changes to the notified text into account in coming to the conclusion that extensions to the subzone are appropriate. Turning to the relevance of case law on the existing environment and the permitted baseline, the landscape evidence of Mr. EC for Mount Cadrona Station notes that a gondola to the snow farm has been enabled by consent RM070610 and assesses this unimplemented consent as forming part of the environment of Cadrona Valley. Mr. Brown's evidence also for Mount Cadrona Station agrees with Mr. Espy's conclusion that it is possible to mitigate the cumulative effects of a second gondola to the Cadrona subzone in addition to the effects of the unimplemented snow farm consent. Mr. Dent for NZSG has also asserted that the existing consented environment is of relevance. The council is required in making a district plan rule in section 76.3 of the RMA to have regard to the actual or potential effect on the environment of activities including, in particular, any adverse effect. The council submits that any consents that have been granted but not yet implemented are not required to be considered as part of the environment, and the important term there is required. The High Court in Shotover Park is authority for the view, and I wish to just change the terminology here, if you don't mind, is authority for the view that it is not mandatory to apply and carry on the existing environment as defined in Hawthorne, which includes implemented consent. And then if you could just delete the words does not apply. So I'll read that sentence again. The High Court in Shotover Park is authority for the point that it is not mandatory to apply the existing environment as defined in Hawthorne, which includes implemented consent to plan changes. The High Court held that Hawthorne was intended to involve a real-world analysis for resource consent applications rather than applying to the plan appeal context. In addition to my written submissions, I just wish to expand on this because this is a matter that has been addressed in legal submissions by Mr. Goldsmith and Ms. Baker Galloway. So the Shotover decision leaves the door open to consider consents that are likely to be implemented. That is not opposed by the council, the submission that's been put forward by other council, but the council's position is that it's not mandatory for the existing environment to apply. I understand from Mr. Goldsmith's submissions that he's arguing that it is mandatory, but I don't believe Ms. Baker Galloway is in her written submission. In paragraph
4 of the High Court shop register. And this is in the summary of the judgment. It clearly sets out the one reason why the court in that case was not obliged to assume that the environment within Plan Change 19 contained the two consents that were of relevance, being the Pack and Save supermarket and Mitre 10 Mega. And it states, this is because when deciding the content of a plan for the future, as distinct from the grant of a particular resource consent, the court is not obliged to confine environment to the existing environment as defined in paragraph 84 of Hawthorne. So that is the only reason given in the summary as to why it came to the conclusions that it did in this case. If we then turn to paragraph 115 of the Shotover case, this has been cited in all of the legal submissions before you, and it's where Justice Fogarty states, in my view, the Court of Appeal in Hawthorne intended paragraph 84 to be a real-world analysis in respect of resource consent applications. The setting of the case was of application for resource consent under section 104, not the application of sections 31 and 32. This is also reflected in paragraph 84, at the time a particular application is considered. The Court of Appeal in Far North District Council recently applied Hawthorne in paragraph 84 of Hawthorne, but again in the context of the application for resource consent, not in the planning context of sections 31 and 32. In the next paragraph, Justice Fogarty then goes on to state, when a territorial authority is deciding the plan for the future, there is nothing in the Act intended to constrain it forward looking thinking. So that is where he doesn't close the door in terms of applying the existing environment Hawthorne concept. But importantly, in the next paragraph, the words that start the first sentence, in any event, if I am wrong on that point, and then Justice Fogarty goes on to consider the likely to be implemented test based on the evidence that was before the court in that hearing. So, if you then in the following, it's on page, before paragraph 122, Ms. Baker-Galloway refers to the analysis and the decision. That analysis is the analysis of the if I am wrong part of this case. And then what it does is it relates to the fallback question and the evidence before the court. So it becomes a question of fact as to whether, for example, the snow farms are likely to implement their consent for a gondola. That in itself is not a legal question, and I do not believe there is any evidence before this panel on that either way, and legal counsel cannot give that evidence themselves.
I'm just trying to understand though where the submission is leading, because as I understand it, you're saying that we did not take account of the snow farm formula consent, and yet Dr. Reid has relied on that consent as the basis for saying there's a cumulative adverse effect. So should we discount Dr.
Reid's
evidence on that point?
I have expanded on the written legal submissions because I was concerned that they were they didn't paint the full picture in terms of what is the correct legal test. In terms of whether a consent is likely to be implemented, that depends on the evidence that is before the panel. The council hasn't called any evidence or sought to call any evidence as to whether it is likely or not that consent is to be implemented. That is acknowledged. And
it was a little surprising now that the council owns the snow farm. So they must have some idea as to whether it will be implemented or not.
Yes, I can't speak to that. I mean, there's no evidence. I can't speak to that. Legal counsel, but I acknowledge that evidence is not before you. Mr. Goldsmith's submissions do give some views on whether it is likely to be implemented or not, but I don't believe those submissions are based on evidence before the panel either. In terms of the council's evidence that then relies on that or refers to the existence of that consent,
Ms. Banks has taken it as a fact that the consent is not beyond appeal and has looked at the consent on its face in terms of what it allows for. She hasn't gone any further to look if from a commercial perspective, it is likely that something she's going to go forward and build or implement that consent. So she's gone as far as saying, well, it's not under appeal, the consent's there, and it can be implemented. So we're in a position where it's acknowledged that the council hasn't called any evidence as to whether it's likely or not that the consent will be implemented. Thinking about the implications of if the council was required to do that, I find it difficult to comprehend a district plan review of almost the entire district where the council needs to go and find every consent that it has granted that has not yet been implemented and look to call evidence on whether it's likely to be implemented or not. That would lead to an absurd outcome, I would think.
I'm still trying to grasp what your submission is. Is your submission that this formula is not relevant, a consent not relevant to considering the Soho and Mount Gerard Station proposals, or is it relevant?
Council's submission is that it is relevant, but it's acknowledged that it hasn't called any evidence
right.
as to it being likely to be implemented.
So then... So then Mr. Estes' consideration of it is as relevant as Dr. Reed's. Because if he sees it as a beneficial thing and Dr. Reed sees it as a negative thing. But they are two different landscape architects and we're used to that with landscape architects.
Yes, well that is a difference in expert opinion. But the council's position is that it's relevant and it can't had a different position in respect to
Mr.
Estes.
That's what I was trying to clarify. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
it didn't come out of your
submission.
No. Sorry, sir. Mr. Chairman, just for you, can I just say that about your my understanding is correct? So I think your changes to 7.2 are quite significant in terms of it's not mandatory. So when I read that, and you know, read this Baker Galloway submission, it seems that your both submissions were directly opposing each other. But what you're now saying, if I'm correctly interpreting the change, it's not mandatory, and it's a bit like the whole committed based on consent, it's a discretionary consideration. You're saying you can take those unimplemented resource consents into account. The issue that we'll need to look at is a factual one, whether they are likely to be implemented or not, which is always difficult. So that's your position. So I'm reading your submissions now, effectively agreeing with Ms. Baker Galloway's submission. Put aside the fact argument, but whether you can take it into account.
Yes, I think that's fair. I just want to emphasise the council submits that any consents that have been granted but not yet implemented are not required to be considered as part of the environment. That already was the submission.
Right.
I just we haven't gone the next step to say the door is still open to do that.
Okay.
So what the Shotover case does not do is say it's mandatory.
Right.
To treat the environment in that way. Section 76 only uses the word environment. It doesn't talk about a physical environment, and it doesn't talk about the concepts that the Hawthorn came through. I mean, Hawthorn came through completely different parts of the RMA.
Exactly. So your submission and Mr. Goldsmith's are still quite different from what you're saying it's not mandatory.
Yes, if I understand.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you. That's much clearer to me. Thank you.
No, I mean, that's helpful because my understanding has always been that, for instance, the unimplemented building platforms in the district, if there was a high concentration, that may determine the zoning that's applied.
Yes.
It's not mandatory to do it, but one might do it as a sensible factual basis for the.
Yes. That's correct. Mm. Yes. And just in addition, one other point is addressed in. The legal submissions of Mr. Goldsmith and Ms. Baker Galloway, that's commercial viability, those submissions are accepted and the council's not arguing that commercial viability is relevant to the overall test of appropriateness, and I just wanted to be clear that that wasn't a legal position of the council. Turning to the remarkable, so I don't think I need to take you through this section as we've already covered it. It relates to Area 1 and
Yes, and
in the paragraph 8.2 we've already referred to the submission of Queenstown Parks, which is being heard in the Queenstown hearing stream.
Yes.
So Kurt, if you don't have any other specific questions,
I do
actually. You do?
You referred in your submissions to the areas that the scheme of your subzone is being applied to have been rolled over from the operative plan. I couldn't find any Section 32 analysis that those areas are based on. Is there any analysis done, or is it just a simple rollover without any further thought?
I believe there was a separate ski areas Section 32 report that in the rural hearing wasn't attached to the Section 42A in error because it didn't sit within the rural Section 32 and the landscape Section 32. That's just my recollection from that hearing. I will need to go away and look at that. I can't answer that.
Yes, well, one of the reasons I've asked that is that in doing the site inspections last week, it's quite apparent that on the Cadrona ski area subzone at least, the lower bounds of that are extraordinarily low, about 750 metres, it seems to me, roughly, which is, well, in one of our worst winters you might be able to ski it. But there's, you know, generally all the evidence we have before us is that 1100 metres is probably the logical lower edge of the ski zones. This is about 400 metres lower than that. But I just wondered whether the council has actually done any analysis as to why that boundary was so low. Because it seems that that boundary coming down so low is almost contradicts some of the evidence the council has providing as to why the ski areas should not be extended, because they extend them to the low valleys.
I'll start by arguing that that would be a good winter in my book.
I do know someone that has skied.
Look, I will go away and have a look at the Section 32 in more detail. My understanding is the council was not looking to take away any development rights that already existed in the operative district plan. And I also understand that there's no submission opposing the any changes to them is beyond the scope of this hearing.
Yes, but I still, I'd like to see if there is any Section 32 analysis that I couldn't find it in any of the material we receive.
No, thank you. We can address that in the council's reply.
Now the other question also relates to the Cadrona ski area subzone. The assessment criteria that apply to ONLs in the reply version, and that's 21.7.1.5 in particular, require and encourage joint access to development areas, and it is a question that we have been wondering, and I noticed it's also raised in Ms. Baker Galloway's submissions, I think it is, why we have to have two points of access to the same ski area subzone, and whether the council, not in its regulatory sense, but in its strategic local government sense, shouldn't be facilitating the combined access up to that ski area subzone.
So is that 21715? Is that what you referred to?
Design density development. The opportunity has been taken to aggregate in development to utilise common access ways, including roads, pedestrian linkages. Development, including accesses located within parts of the site that is least visible. Now, these apply outside of the ski area subzones, obviously, but the only way to get access into that ski area subzone is through the outstanding natural landscape. That's accepted by all the witnesses. Now, my question is whether the council should actually be doing something outside of this regime to actually facilitate one common access to that whole area, rather than forcing a regulatory system that forces two or more access into the area, contrary to that which there. And it's not something that I'm asking you to make submissions on, I'm asking you to take it back to your clients.
Yes, sir, I will do that, and we can address it in the reply. I'm just perhaps being a bit dim, but trying to understand the requirement of two access ways through this assessment matter.
Well, what I'm saying is that development should be clustered, and you should only have one means of access to it. That's essentially what that assessment matter says. And that if you were doing the development of an OML, from a consenting point of view, that would be the criteria of not having multiple access ways, one into each piece of development. Here we've got one serious subzone that can be serviced by one means of access to the whole zone. If you look carefully at where the existing four-wheel drive track to Soho goes to, it actually goes to the Cadrona Ski Field car park. It doesn't go to a different place. And their main route of access adjoins one of the Cadrona runs. You know, it seems to me that the way the zoning, or the way the framework has been set out in the plan, is encouraging two axes when one would do.
I see.
And
okay.
But we can't force that. And that the council has other responsibilities and abilities that it could do some sort of facilitation to make the three parties talk to each other, or four parties it may be.
Thank you.
That's
I
what
understand.
I'm getting at.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. I'll go away and speak to the council and cover that in the council's reply as well.
Yeah. But I don't think it's something that we can deal with in the plan itself, so it may not even need to be in the reply.
No, it's not. take your message on board.
Yes. The other question is a more general one, and it relates to the nature of the evidence we've received in support of the changes sought. And I'd like to have your view on whether the evidence that we have to consider when we're providing for activities such as a passenger lift system as a controlled activity as sought by Mount Shagun Station Limited, or the activities that Mr. Kent is supporting NZ Ski's lower area by the state highway, whether the evidence we receive should be the same as or similar to the level of evidence that would be expected for a resource consent application. We're using different sections of the Act, but should we be satisfied with something lesser or something more or something similar in your view from a legal point of view?
The evidence before you needs to satisfy you as to the statutory test that is relevant to a plan change, that is making a decision on what is the most appropriate planning framework for that area of land or the two being considered. What has almost occurred in this hearing is that because these submitters are essentially seeking a bespoke corridor only for a gondola and excluding other ski area facilities that are contemplated under a ski area such owner, it is almost in effect a quasi consent application to allow that rule to come through. This is something that we have struggled with, but ultimately it's the council's submission that the panel needs to take a step back and apply the correct test, which is what is the most appropriate zoning. That does not mean that you need the level of evidence required for a resource consent. They are two separate processes, but they've got a little bit merged given the specific relief that the submitters are seeking. And that's what I alluded to in my legal submission, where I talked about how the submitters are using the ski area subzone objectives and policies to essentially insert a rule specific to gondolas in the rural zone.
Well, if we were to agree with the submitters that a gondola could be a controlled activity within the corridor, that is tantamount to granting a consent, isn't it? So that takes me back to the original question. To do that, would we need to have the evidence, notwithstanding that it's a different test? The test is not a lesser test for a zoning, is it?
You're correct, sir. The council would only have ability to apply conditions as they are listed in the method of control, and of course they couldn't essentially impose conditions that effectively decline the consent in terms of location, etc. So once a controlled activity rule goes into the planning framework, the council's hands are to an extent tied, I guess, in terms of granting that consent. So in terms of the evidence that is before you, the panel does need to be satisfied that the effects on the environment, including under section 76, which I referred to you earlier, which talks about any adverse effects, it needs to be satisfied that there is sufficient evidence to justify that those effects might be adverse.
Now, if it was a restricted discretionary activity, Does that change it? Or is it a matter of what the discretion is given to the council? And you might want to consider the restricted discretionary activity provision that Mr. Barr recommended in the prior version before you answer.
Sir, I will go away and take a look at that in more detail. What is very important is that the matters of discretion are sufficiently comprehensive in terms of ensuring they cover the matters of concern to the council. That would allow it to either impose conditions of consent or decline consent. From your question, you may be suggesting that those matters of discretion are not wide enough.
I'm not suggesting one thing or the other. I'm just asking. I mean, the submitters are relying on that evidence provided by Mr. Barr, and I think that then I think the council needs to address that itself.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think I've got three, and some of them might really be clarification. And I said I'm slightly in catch-up mode in some of these things. So just to go to 1.1, I just want to be clear on your statement, of your submission, where you basically say these set of hearings are around lines on maps and zoning, but almost say the text has been dealt with. Of course, in this hearing, a number of the submitters have asked for text changes. Are you saying that we don't have the ability to do that, or what are you saying when you say that this is just about lines or maps, essentially? Because I think in the end this is all about changes to text, largely, with most of them now saying we don't give extensions.
Yes. So, no, I'm not saying that you cannot recommend changes to the text, but there may be instances where specific changes are required to objectives and policies in order to justify a certain subzone extension or a rezoning if we're in one of the other rezoning hearings. And that needs to happen. There is also, for example, Ms. Banks has recommended some minor changes to the text which missed in the rural hearing, and to clarify and ensure that there's no uncertainty in certain rules. The council's position is you can, but there is a, we have been through a comprehensive hearing process where the submissions on the text have been considered, recommendations made, submitters have been given an opportunity to come and present their evidence to the hearing panel. At the end of this process, there is going to be a need to ensure that the recommendations of the panels align. In terms of the final recommendation and decision.
I suppose that was, sorry.
Can I just, on that point, if we were to find that some text changes were needed in, for instance, Chapter 21, would it be appropriate for us to use the same mechanism that you suggested in the definitions hearing, that we would recommend to the Stream 2 panel, the Stream 2 panel, that these changes be made and that become part of their recommendation to the council, but it be our recommendation to them rather than us recommending separately?
Yes, it would be.
Right.
Yes,
sir. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That was around my second question. Of course, the panel is here and will be making a recommendation to the council, either in an ink sense, and it's almost artificial, you know, the way that plans have to get cut up in terms of you hear this bit, then you hear this bit, and you they can't be done in isolation, I suggest, and hence what the question is. That's fine. So coming to 2.3 and 2.4, this is just this issue of the broadening of the purpose of the ski subzone, and I think your submissions and the evidence, I suppose the question, it's accepted, I think, from the council's position is that it has been broadened out from just skiing activities, but it talks about tourist activities. And when I started to read that, I wondered whether it had to be read in the form of related to skiing activities, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's broader. So that is the council's position, that the ski subzones, what we call ski subzones, are intended from the council's position to be somewhat broader, full-time, all year round, and may include other activities which are not ski related.
Yes, that's correct. And just to clarify the point of that submission, so the council recommended the expansion of the purpose of the subzones, as you just described, in the rural hearing. And it was doing that on the basis of the notified extent of the ski area subzones. The submissions are now using that expanded purpose to say, well, that now fits our additional area that we want to have rezoned to subzone as well.
Now, so that's the point I was going to make, because I think Ms. Benson, some reason, sort of accepts that and then uses that as the argument why it may not be appropriate. But presumably, from the council's position, when it looked at the submissions overall, when the submissions came in, there were some people seeking a broader, but also seeking expansion. So is it disingenuous to say that it's a different concept and wasn't contemplated? Because it may well have been contemplated. And hence this idea of you can't sort of separate these things, two things out too specifically.
Yes, well, the extensions were, of course, contemplated in terms of Mr. Barr's recommendations in rural. He was aware of the submission seeking that subzone be extended. He accepted that the purpose of the existing ski area subzones had somewhat expanded compared to what was notified. He accepted that was not fit for purpose anymore for those confined areas. So he made that recommendation in terms of the notified ski area subzone, which was, it is a little bit complicated, but that was what we were considering in the context of the rural hearing.
And then the same thing, just going to the provisions around earthworks in your sort of 5.1 through to 5.6. It's the same issue. It seems to suggest that because the existing notified ski subzones are not subject to the earthworks, and I think that Ms. Banks talks about it, and you put that in your submission, is that if it wasn't contemplated that there might be extensions to the zones and the earthworks not applied. I suppose the legal position, though, isn't it, is if the panel recommended and the council accepted that the ski zone should be extended, then earthworks would not apply to those because the operative plan excludes them, notwithstanding they have come after.
That is the legal position, right. That's correct. Of course, the operative plan and the earthworks chapter came before.
I mean, exactly, exactly.
But just to add to that, Kim Banks' recommendation, for example, in respect of Area 1, before the boundary issue came into play, was that that recommendation to accept the rezoning is on the proviso that earthworks still need to be considered, and she's not accepting that earthworks that they should be accepted. Mr. Dent, I think, for NZSB, has also accepted in his evidence and in the provisions he's suggesting that restricted discretionary activity would be appropriate for that zone extension, and he has suggested an additional rule. What the council is saying is, well, that's great, the submitter has acknowledged that there should be a consent requirement for earthworks, but it shouldn't fit as a bespoke rule in the rural zone. It should be located in the earthworks provision. So if the panel is minded to agree with the submitter and recommend that subzone be accepted, then that recommendation should come with the qualifier that there is also a restricted discretionary rule for earthworks, but rather than it sitting in Chapter 21, it needs to sit in the earthworks chapter, which we don't yet have in the proposed district plan.
And doesn't that pose a problem in recommending that?
Well, it's just about the location of the rule as to where it sits. I mean, it could sit for the time being in the subzones, but ultimately, council's position is it should sit in the district-wide chapter with the remainder of the earthworks rules.
So that's helpful. So that's what you mean, your 5.5, you said the council opposes duplicating the provisions.
Yes,
right.
Yes, so it's about the location of that earthworks rule. So Mr. Dent's evidence suggests that the restricted discretionary activity rule should sit within his subzone B. Council's saying, well, that's great that he's acknowledged that that's appropriate. It's about the location of that rule. So I don't see there being any issue as to the panel making a recommendation that there should be an earthworks rule for that area of land. It's a matter of just where it sits in the proposed district plan.
Thank you for that, because I have read that in the other way, that the panel shouldn't make a recommendation about putting in earthworks solutions in there. That was just my interpretation, because when I was looking at these things in terms of the extension, presumably one of the matters that we would need to consider is that if the earthworks provisions didn't apply, whether it's appropriate to extend the subzone. Yeah, okay, no, that's clear, I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My fellow commissioner got the answer I needed for the expanded use for the inter and all seasons there. I'll have to have a read through Mr. Barr's wording on that, because I'd say that the all seasons commercial recreation facilities would be utilising the ski facilities as opposed to building new facilities just for a summer operation. I'm just wondering if he's defined that.
I don't think it's defined, but that is the intention of, for example, mountain bikers using the existing gondolas to get up the hill, come back down again.
I will have a look back through that one. Thanks.
Or is this in left?
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. In terms of the order of calling evidence, what I was proposing to do is call Mr. Glasner first, followed by Dr. Lloyd, as he had somewhere else to be this afternoon, and then turning to Dr. Reid, then Mr. Davis, and followed finally by Ms. Banks.
Thank you very much, Stella. Thank you, Commissioner Chair, Commissioner. Oh, thank you very much.
So just before Mr. Glasson starts, he's filed one statement of rebuttal evidence for this hearing.
Yes. My name is Ulrich Glasner. I'm working for QRDC. I'm the chief engineer. This is the summary evidence in regards of the ski area sub-zone here in Spring number 11. I have provided rebuttal evidence for Queenstown Lakes District Council in relation to infrastructure matters regarding proposed extensions to the ski area sub-zones and in the proposed district plan. My rebuttal evidence responds to the dense planning evidence on Area 2, proposed ski area sub-zone B, which is thought to apply to approximately 21.6 hectares of the base of the remarkable ski field access road. His evidence is that there is a lack of water and wastewater servicing in this location, and that any future development of the site will require the submitter to demonstrate and pay for any extension and increased capacity to council reticulated services or the provision of on-site facilities. In relation to the former option of extending and joining council reticulated services, there are no council reticulated services in the vicinity, the closest being at Henley Downs. Council has no plans to extend water and wastewater servicing to the base of the ski field access road, nor are there any projects in the current long-term plan. In my opinion, it is not in Council's best interest for its water and wastewater networks to extend further into currently zoned rural lands outside the urban limits, as this will result in increased operational maintenance and renewal costs for the Council over the long term. New Zealand Ski Limited's proposed provisions would not enable Council to recover the full costs of growth associated with the extension of services to this location, noting that there is no reticulated infrastructure in the vicinity to connect to in any event, and would not align with current strategic infrastructure planning processes under the LTP. Council could not seek development contributions from the developer under any consent issued within an extended proposed flood zone B, as the council's current policy of development contributions and financial contributions does not allow the council to impose development contributions within the rural zone under which the FASZ sits for the three waters, unless the particular area is supplied by a scheme or the development is joining to an existing scheme. Even if council were to provide services to the site, which even with the developer's initial funding is not council's intention, I also consider that it would be difficult for the site to connect to the services it handed down. This is because the capacity of the wastewater network is already fully allocated for the development of Henley Downs and Jack's Point. This is similar in relation to the water supply for Henley Downs. Any services could therefore need to be provided on-site and funded by the developer, as Mr. Dent accepts at his paragraph 159. I'm not opposed to on-site systems, provided that they are designed to protect the environment and are suitable for on-site ground conditions. I note, however, that given the location, there is no intention at all from the council that such an on-site service funded by the developer at this location be joined to existing council networks at a later date, and there is no existing infrastructure in any event. Such an outcome would result in increased operational maintenance and renewal costs for council over long term.
It's just on the development contributions and financial contributions policy. It's always possible for council to change that policy. And with the long-term plan is up for renew next year.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
No, I have no questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wisner. I will now turn to Mr. Lloyd. Mr. Lloyd is an ecologist and he has addressed the extensions at Coronet Peak and the Remarkables.
Thank you. I've been engaged by Queensland Lake District Council to provide evidence in relation to ecological matters regarding proposed extensions to the notified ski area sub-zones at the Remarkables and Coronet Peak and the proposed land. My evidence relates to the submission of NZ Ski Limited. In their primary submission, NZ Ski requested rezoning to ski area subzone of four areas of land associated with the Remarkables ski area subzone and the Coronet Peak ski area subzone. In relation to the requested extension at the Remarkables, I do not oppose the request to rezone Area 1, being the strip of land between the existing ski area subzone and the central Otago district boundary. I just note that there's some questions about whether that strip is included or not, but my opinion still holds for the remaining area above Lake Altamont, which is similar. Because large parts of this area comprise poorly vegetated boulder field and scree, and clearance of indigenous vegetation would be subject to Department of Conservation approval or would otherwise be a discretionary activity. I also do not oppose the request to rezone proposed subzone B, being 21.67 hectares of land located at the base of the Remarkable Ski Field Access Road, as this area comprises remnants of indigenous scrubland that have been heavily invaded by exotic woody weeds, and there are no important ecological values at present that would be affected by ski area developments. At Coronet Peak, I oppose an extension of the ski area subzone into the Back Bowls area, as this area is relatively intact for a predominantly indigenous cover and supports indigenous plant communities on naturally disturbed habitats that would be vulnerable to the adverse effects of ski field activity. In particular, increased levels of disturbance would likely result in exotic grasses and herbs displacing these indigenous communities and naturally disturbed sites. I do not oppose the extension of the ski area subzone into Dirty Fall Creek, with vegetation clearance being a discretionary activity, as this catchment has already been modified by ski field activities and the landforms are less steep and less vulnerable to the propagation of potential adverse effects. As any clearance of indigenous vegetation above 1,070 metres above sea level is a discretionary activity for all zones, and the requested rezone of Dirty Fall Creek occurs above 1,070 metres above sea level, any clearance of indigenous vegetation from the rezoned land would require resource consent. I consider that discretionary activity status provides the QLDC with the ability to consider all relevant ecological issues and to impose robust conditions to avoid, remedy or mitigate any adverse effect.
Just a question on Coronet Peak, taking into account the Valley Commissioner's comment. But just with the back bowl area that you oppose, so do you like the ski activity that happens on that on those back bowls is quite common presently. So it's outside the ski area, so I guess like the natural disturbance of the habitat would be just through trail formation as opposed to people actually skiing on snow on top of that plant and indigenous vegetation.
Yeah, I'm not concerned about activities that occur on top of the snow.
Yeah.
From what I understand, talking to the ski area manager, that there's not often enough snow in that basin. I think he said once every 10 years. But activities that disturb the substrate, that those certainly are my concern.
Okay, thank you.